Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I am the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library. I would like to warmly welcome everyone for the second evening of our Spring 2009 Live from the New York Public Library season. A quick but timely word about supporting this extraordinary institution, the New York Public Library. I would like to ask everyone present to consider becoming a friend of the library. Starting for as little as $40 a year, you are in. Please become a friend of the New York Public Library. Your support will go and will get you a $15 ticket for all live events instead of $25. That is a $10 saving each and every time. There's a membership table here. Please visit it after the event and join tonight. It will help our cause tremendously. Of course, you can also do so online. What is our cause, you may ask? Quite simply and joyously, to bring you live conversations, discussions, debates, to present you with the best thinking around town, what I like to call cognitive theater. You will also want to have the pleasure of viewing the events on iTunes U, on our website, reading transcripts of past evenings, be they conversations between John Hope Franklin and President Clinton, Al Sharpton and Christopher Hitchens, Gunter Grass and the late Norman Mailer, who made his last public appearance here, Zadie Smith, Krista Tippett and Stuart Brown, Toni Morrison, Alfred Brendel, Jan Morris, Robert Badinter, Jhumpa Lahiri and Mira Nair, Werner Herzog and many, many, many more. And the list goes on. So check it out. And what events are coming up, you might ask? Week after next, we will be hosting a tribute to the late John Updike with David Remnick, ZZ Packer, Sonny Mehta, Laurie Moore, and many others. Shortly after that, a conversation with Thomas Friedman. Andrei Kondrescu will interview Henry Alford and Mark Twain. This will be actually my first impersonification of Twain. Follows a two-part series this spring, co-presented with Book Forum, entitled Cultural Obituaries on the Deaths of Black Nationalism and the Deaths of Boom Culture. A two-part evening will follow with Alex Ross, Barbara Eisenberg, and Frank Gehry, followed by Alex Ross interviewing the composer and conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen, and much more. Join our email list, but also, and here's something brand new, a week old, please join our blog at www.nypl.org/blog. Ask questions of the talent before the event and after. Abi Warburg, you may remember, spoke eloquently of the afterlife of the work of art. Now the time has come, I think, to speak of the afterlife of live conversations. Let us hear your voice. We want to read what interests you, where you agree, and why not let us hear your dissenting voice as well. We have a sign-up sheets at the information table. Any questions not asked today during the event can be asked afterwards. And I will ask and urge Father Patrick Desbois and Paul Leclerc to answer those questions later on. After the conversation, please join Father Patrick Desbois for a book signing. As always, many thanks to our independent bookseller, 192 Books. I would also like to particularly thank Alessandra Bastali, senior editor at Palgrave, who in no small way was instrumental in making sure this evening took place. Alessandra, I hope you know how grateful I am to you. Thank you also to Lauren Dwyer, also from Palgrave, and for all your precious and timely help, and to David Black and Stephanie Blayer. Intramuros, my thanks always goes to Meg Stemmler and Kim Irwin, who were closely with me on all matters live from the New York Public Library. It is a great honor now to welcome Father Patrick Desbois to the New York Public Library, and no less of an honor to have the president of this great library, Paul Leclerc, be in conversation with Father Patrick Desbois. Father Patrick Desbois is the author of Porteur de Mémoire, provocatively translated into English as A Holocaust by Bullets. This book was awarded the National Jewish Book Award. The Holocaust by Bullets is a story of Father Desbois' heroic mission to investigate the murder of Ukrainian Jews by Nazis during World War II. He and his team have visited the sites of these murders and interviewed surviving witnesses, many of whom were recruited by the Germans to assist in the executions. Father Patrick Desbois is secretary to the French Conference of Bishops for Relationships with Judaism, an advisor to the Cardinal, Archbishop of Lyon, and an advisor to the Vatican on Jewish religion. Grandson of a deportee of the Rawa-Ruska camp, Father Desbois has set out to investigate the mass murders of Eastern European Jews by Nazis during the Second World War. I urge you all to find out more about Father Desbois' work by going to his website, www.holocaustbybullets.com. I repeat, www.holocaustbybullets.com. Paul Leclerc is a president and chief executive officer of the New York Public Library, which consists of 91 libraries that serve a more varied set of constituencies and has the broadest mission of any library in the nation, perhaps in the world. Dr. Leclerc is the author or co-editor of 5 scholarly volumes on writers of the French Enlightenment. I might add that I know him to have a particular love of Voltaire, particularly for Candide, so our proximity to Bryant Park has always seemed quite natural and fitting to me. Paul Leclerc's contribution to French letters and cultures have earned him the Order of the Academic Palms in 1989 and the French Legion of Honor in 1996. Now it gives me great pleasure to present to you Father Patrick Desbois and Paul Leclerc. Before they come up to the podium, we're going to show you a small short video of 7 minutes.
Throughout Ukraine, over 1.5 million Jews were executed by the Nazis. Until today, nobody knew precisely what had become of these victims. A whole chapter of the Shoah forgotten.
Ici, il n'y a pas de chambre à gaz, il n'y a pas de camp, il n'y a pas de tatouage. On tue tout le monde très rapidement. On les fusille. C'est la Shoah par balles, je dirais, sur tout un continent. On a cru à l'Ouest qu'on ne pourrait jamais retrouver ces Juifs. Les victimes de la Shoah, on croyait qu'elles étaient disparues. Mais ici, elles n'ont pas disparu. Elles ont été enterrées, souvent sous un fossé. On revient aujourd'hui sur chaque endroit d'assassinat pour retrouver qui a été tué, où sont les corps, que les preuves soient établies et qu'on puisse les enterrer dignement, puisqu'on dit que l'humanité commence par l'enterrement des corps.
Olga was 12 years old in 1942. 12 years old when she witnessed it all.
А как вы узнали, что здесь именно расстреливали?
Та батьки говорили вдома, всі говорили, то всі знали, що стріляли їх на укописку. А туди, як ми ще ходили дивити, то дуже багато вели євреїв в той день. Так було їх коло 60.
D'où elle commençait la fosse?
А яма, откуда она начала?
Та вона то загорнена.
Та десь
такого звідти було, такого, звідти туди. І так по партії їх виставили рядок, постріляли. Потім знову виставили рядок, знову постріляли.
Est-ce que la fusillade c'était comme ça?
Ну, вони стоять, так стояли і розстрілювали.
Так. Le chef était comme ça.
А командуючий був?
В стороні стояв.
Il était sur le côté.
Ici, il descendait pas dans la fosse.
Ні. Їх ставили так коло ями і
розстрілювали.
Ну, що ми зі школи прийшли, діти?
Ils étaient comme ça.
But the question remained how to demonstrate that the witnesses were telling the truth, that the Jewish population of Ukraine was indeed exterminated and buried where this rural memory had designated. In August 2006, to verify the truth, he decided to exhume the mass graves of the city of Busk. Here, the Jewish community was 5 centuries old. After 3 weeks of meticulous excavations, the archaeologists discovered the unbearable. Under their instruments, 1,700 skeletons were revealed, clearly displaying the horror of their last moments alive. Most were shot with a bullet to the head. Others, without apparent traces, were most likely buried alive. As ultimate proof of these killings, Misha, the ballistics expert who works with the priest, found hundreds of German cartridges near the mass graves. For Father Desbois, the witnesses were telling the truth. No further doubts could be foreseen. But constrained by religious regulations, the digs were stopped at the first layer of skeletons.
Як почався розстріл?
Да.
Скільки це пасу?
Що стало? Як це було?
Це було у п'ятницю. Ну, ми були там калорійські, виймали сівалку. Нас було 9 хлопців. Але чуємо так бах-бах, щось бахкає. Ми так глянули, якісь машини тут на могилках, на окопичку. Ми глянули, бачимо, що пруть. 3 поліцаї і німець один. Ми в ноги, а вони по нас стріляти. Ми стали. Що ви за єдни? Ми там ще бабку виймали, та й ще є. А чого ви тут ходите? А ну вон звідси. Ну зараз постріляємо. Ми в ноги. Ну, ми в ноги повтікали, тут хата була крайня, от колоса молкопівська. Ми за ту хату. І дивитися, як вони. Машина за машиною. Привозили ті чорні ворони. Випихали їх просто звідти. Хто як міг, діти мали, то кидали. Я не можу розказувати.
Ну, заспокойтеся.
І ми за руку кинув яму. А тих.
Ils sont des milliers à avoir vu la Shoah de près on leur a jamais rien demandé. Et souvent on leur a demandé, comme à ce monsieur, pourquoi il parle. Et la réponse a toujours été la même depuis toutes les régions d'Ukraine, c'est parce que vous me demandez. Et on leur dit, mais quelqu'un vous a demandé quelque chose depuis 42? Ils disent non, jamais. Donc en fait, ils racontent pour la première fois et peut-être pour la dernière fois l'histoire de ce qu'ils ont vu. La vérité de la Shoah à l'Est, c'est-à-dire ici, réside dans la conscience des pauvres. Et donc en gros, c'est aussi la Shoah vue par les petites gens qui n'étaient pas pris dans l'idéologie soviétique et qui finalement racontent. Ils racontent avec leur langue populaire ce qui s'est passé. C'est la première fosse que j'ai découverte en fait. C'était pour moi la grande surprise. Je me rappelle, j'étais assis là et les témoins sont arrivés. Ils ont raconté leur histoire. Moi, j'avais pas de caméra comme là aujourd'hui, j'avais pas d'appareil photo. Et d'un seul coup, je découvrais qu'on pouvait trouver où étaient enterrés les Juifs, mais aussi que c'était nulle part, comme voilà. Et puis qu'il n'y avait rien de marqué. Et c'est là en fait où j'ai tout découvert.
maire, enfin, l'ancien maire, Yaroslav, a décidé de faire protéger le site. C'est lui-même qui a mis en place tout ça. Et là, aujourd'hui, il scelle une étoile de David pour signifier que c'est une tombe juive. Et le fait que ce soit des Ukrainiens, puisqu'ils le fassent, ça veut dire aussi qu'ici, il y a des gens qui veulent que la mémoire se garde et qu'on sache où on a tué les Juifs et qu'est-ce qu'ils sont devenus, et qu'on réinscrive l'étoile de David sur la sol de l'Ukraine. Il n'y a pas d'étoile de David sur tout le sol de cette région. Je crois que ça sera la première dans la grande région.
Each day that goes by, the eyewitnesses disappear one by one. And with them, a part of the work of Father Desbois, the memory keeper.
I think we should begin by applauding this extraordinary man who did this. Thank you very much to all of you for coming this evening, and Father Desbois, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
For spending time with us at the New York Public Library tonight. I urge you all to read this book. I can tell you honestly that it is a brilliant piece of work, not at all easy to read, and not at all easy to learn of the extraordinarily inhuman things that were done by, as Father Desbois says in the book, one human being to another consistently across a landscape that is absolutely enormous. As Father Desbois told me a short while ago, Ukraine is not a small country. It's as big as France. It's as big as the state of Texas. It has 60,000 inhabitants, as many as France does. And it is, as he describes in the book, a country of cemeteries. I kind of like the lights up high for the whole room. Can you do that? Thank you. We're going to talk for a little while, he and I, and maybe for a half hour, 40 minutes or so, and then we'll open it to questions from you. And I'm sure that everyone will have a question on her or his mind, and we'll entertain as many of those as we can before we move to a book signing. Father Desbois, I think this is your first book.
Yeah.
And you told me as we were walking down the hall that in this book there are about one-tenth of the things that you could have written about. So how did you make the selection between what was appropriate to put down on paper and what you thought was best kept in your own heart or in your mind?
First, it was not easy to write this book, because when we arrive in a farm of Ukraine, when we meet with the people who were forced, by example, to dig the grave or to carry the Jews from the village to the mass grave by cart with horses, or to bring back the suits and to sell the suits and so on. These people, it's the first time they speak since 42. And you know, they are poor people, so there is no image, no symbol, no allegory. So most of the time, I would say, they also explain. By example, I will give you an example to be concrete. A girl, she told me, I was in my farm. Suddenly, a German arrived. I was 12 years old. And he asked me to climb in the trees and pick up the pieces of corpse of the Jews who came from the explosion and to hide them in the mass grave. And she will give you the maximum of details. So my question was how to transmit that to Western population was very far from here. Here you, when you go outside, you will not meet geese, dogs barking, and horses, and also to transmit the horror of this genocide, because it was not normal shootings. Jews were really massacred one by one. By, you know, they established this law in July 1941. One bullet, one Jew, one bullet. It was a request of the Wehrmacht to make economy of ammunition. So because of that, if the Jews were only injured, they were pushers who pushed the Jews in the mass grave. And, by example, every farmer in the village says, I remember the mass grave after the shooting was moving during 3 days. Or it took 3 days for the mass grave to die. And for me, it took 1 year to accept, to understand. So I think the main challenge in this book was how to transmit the truth so that it can be accessible for people who are living now in modern country, very far from these very wild stories.
But what I found particularly interesting was the challenge that you faced, because there were very rich and abundant records that existed, millions of pages of documents in microform at the Holocaust Museum in Washington that were documents assembled by the Soviets when they invaded, and then other records by the Germans themselves, who were meticulous in their record keeping of what they were doing. And yet at the same time, I think you asked yourself a question as to how reliable the records of these particular inquests were by the Soviets. And you set yourself out, I think, not only to document, but really to prove in a comprehensive kind of way what really happened. And can you talk a little bit about, since we are a library rich with archives, and you've spent a lot of time yourself as a researcher in archives, can you talk about the relationship between archival material and its sufficiency or insufficiency, and then what you had to establish as a kind of methodology and a set of protocols? And I realize that the methodology evolved as the process evolved. And so how did you put yourself between the land and the landscape of Ukraine and the archives that exist in many different parts of the world, but that you had access to in Israel and in Washington and in other places?
First, to let know, I am not alone anymore. We built a small team, nine researchers, in an association called Yarad Adinunum, together in Hebrew and in Latin. I have one researcher who works in Washington, in Holocaust Museum, Washington Research Center. There are 16 million of pages of Soviet archives.
60?
Yes, 16.
16?
1-6.
Still a lot.
Still a lot, yeah. In each village, immediately after the German left the village, they did a small investigation in the village. How they did, the local judge interrogated all the neighbors of the mass grave, like we are doing nowadays. Mm-hmm. All these papers are written by hand, because we have the first version before it's treated by the KGB in Moscow. Uh-huh. The second source is the German archives. The German archives are archives of justice, in fact. So the German people, they speak only when they are put on trial. So it's not so much useful because, by example, they say, oh, yeah, I was also in this village. Yeah, perhaps, yes, we shot Jews in this village. Uh-huh. And that's it. What we do, we collect all these archives and we classify them by village. Soviet archive, German archive. When we arrive on the ground, 9-person Franco-Ukrainian team, the first old lady that we meet, we stop the car. One of my translators, Svetlana, goes outside and she raises always the same question. Madame, you were here during the war? And if she says yes, we say, oh, you can help us. Because in Soviet Union, never a negative question. Because it remembers them, KGB. Only positive question. And me, I wait in the car, hidden with the other people, and sooner or later, Svetlana goes to the house of a witness. It means somebody was forced by the Nazi to be at the mass grave to make the black job. When I see they don't move anymore, I arrive. My translator says, oh, here's the priest.
In the way you're...
Yeah, with my color and so on. Here is a priest. We work with him. We are an association, Yarad, and so on. And they always ask, it will be shown in Ukraine? No, it's not for Ukraine. It's for the big museum of America, of Israel. Oh, it's okay. And I say, you were really here at the mass grave? And you saw in the small movies, the witnesses. They remember everything. So suddenly they say, yes, they forced me. By example, an old lady, she was sitting on a bench in front of her house. It was a summer. And she said, yes, I remember. They forced me between every shooting to walk down in the mass grave with 14 Ukrainian girls and to walk on the corpse so that it will be more space for the others to be shot. And she told me at the end, I saw all my school arriving. It was a Jewish school. And they shot them in front of me, and I had to walk on their corpse like the others. At this moment, I know it's true. So I call my team. We arrive, professional team, cameraman, photographer, historian, and we make an interview. I would say it's not an effective interview. It's to rebuild the crime. For example, where from the cars the German was arriving? From this road or from this road? Where did they park? Did they speak German or Russian? Oh, we didn't speak Russian. So who was the translator? Ah, it was somebody from the village. Who was him? And so on and so on. Mm-hmm. And little by little, we bring them until the time of the shooting. If they can walk, we bring, at the end of the day, all the witnesses around the grave to confront them with a camera. And if it's clear, my ballistic specialist, he looked for cartridges. Because the Germans, they didn't care to let evidences. Mm-hmm. So all the cartridges are still on the ground under 5 centimeters. And each cartridge has the name of the brand and the date of fabrication. So we transmit them after to scientific police to have a real statement. Uh-huh. We discovered also that the Jews, before the mass grave, they are asked to undress. And most of the Jewish girls refuse to give their jewels to the German. So they hide them, either the wedding rings, either the Magen David, and so on. So sometime near Mars grave, we find 20, 30 wedding rings or Magen David, which is the last thing that this Jewish girl let before to die. So it's in confronting the evidences, German archive, Soviet archive, oral memory, ballistic investigation, and artifact, that we can make a statement.
So that technique then, I think, is immensely successful in, for the first time, creating an irrefutable documentation about what happened in that specific place. And then the case builds village after village after village across this enormous country. And I think the sum total of Jewish victims that you've identified at this point is 1.5 million people, which is on top of the 6 million that we conventionally talk about. Is that not the case? When we talk about the show, until your work, I think we've been talking, the 6 million, I think, does not include the victims.
A part of them was included, a part of them was not included.
I see. But as in reading your book, I saw that the methodology that you finally arrived at, which you've just described, is one that was built almost by discovery, piecemeal.
So
first there was... beginning with witnesses, then having them take you to sites, and then at a certain point the ballistic evidence. Yeah. And then I think it was a real revelation to you to find how people were requisitioned, because the kind of language that was always used was, as you say in the book, in the passive tense, they were taken. This happened, that happened. But the question that you ask and that you find answered is, who took them? And talk a little bit about the notion of being requisitioned. What kind of people were requisitioned? And ultimately, I think we'll come back and say, what effect did they have on them? Especially because all the witnesses that you talked to were all children at the time.
Yeah. Most of the witnesses that I meet were children between 6 years old to 16 in the time of the killing. And I discovered that the first thing that the Nazi did in a village, they went to see the mayor, and they asked, how many Jews in the district? And you know, in Soviet Union, Jew was written in the passport, like Tatar, like Armenian, like all the minorities. So it was easy. For example, in the district, the mayor said there are 1,670 Jews, and they also the addresses. automatically the Nazi asked the mayor to make requisition of children. By example, to have 50 children to dig the grave. The day after, this German is a specialist of the digging of the grave. He will calculate the volume of the grave according to the number of victims he wants to kill. You must understand also that the mass graves are killing machines because people are thrown alive. Some mass graves are very long with stairs so that the Jews have to walk down and to lay on the corpse to make economy of time. It has been called Sardinenpackung. Other mass graves are run because they want to shoot them with machine gun, etc. After that, when it's finished, he phones to the region to ask the killing unit to come. The killing unit will come in the city, but in the city they will phone to everybody who has a pistol, to Wehrmacht, to Ukrainian police, to German police, to German gendarmerie, to form a unit of killers. They will sleep the night in the village, and on the morning they will surrender the village and make an announce that the Jews are deported to Palestine or to Kiev or to where, it depends, but mainly to Palestine. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's a trick. I met one witness. She told me, I was watching at the window and I saw one of my neighbors entering in the column to be shot. And she told us, don't cry, don't cry. We go to Palestine. Yeah. And she told me, I was with my cow early behind the church and I saw the grave. I knew where was Palestine. So finally, after one moment, they say to these people to walk. They are in column 5x5. And they have 100 meters before the mass grave to undress. Here are waiting other children who are required by the mayor with their cart and horses. They immediately charge the suits in their cart and they bring back the suits in the school to sell them the day after. After the Jews, very quickly, 5x5 are brought, in fact, in front of the killers. Why 5x5? Because one bullet, one Jew, and most of the time there are five shooters. In one village, we saw they shot in one day 1,500 persons with three shooters. Near the mass grave are pushers, German people too, with uniform and gloves to throw the people in the mass grave. Very quickly, the same children fulfill the mass grave with sand. It took me perhaps 1 year to accept that. One day, one old man, he told me, I was fulfilling the mass grave with sand, and suddenly somebody from the mass grave took my spade with the hand. And I say, what? Because the Jews were alive? He told me, of course they were alive. So, you know, the main difficulty of this duty was also to accept to know. When the mass grave is fulfilled, they bring back all the suits of the men in one class, the suits of the women in another class, the suits of the children in the third class, and they sell them by auction. I met many witnesses who said after 3 days, all the district was suited in Jew. After they bring the furniture of the Jewish houses, village by village, inside the school too. 4 weeks ago, I was with my team of Yared Hinnunum in a village. It was Christmas, Christian Orthodox Christmas. And the guy, he was required to dig the grave. He remembered the size, 4 meter per 4 meter. After he was hidden behind a bush to look at the execution, and after he was required to take all the furniture of the Jewish houses, and he was remembering that many houses have few floors, he had to find ropes to bring all the furniture through the windows, etc., and to sell them in the synagogue. And after, he proposes to make the meal of Christmas. It's also very difficult for that because the team has not to show anything.
You can't have an emotional reaction.
You can have, but you must not show it.
Yes,
if you move only one eye, they understand that you are from West, you are not from their world, they stop to speak. Uh-huh. So if you make, it's finished. At the beginning, I stopped many interviews.
Because it was too overwhelming.
No, it's too much. By example, one woman, she was from Sataniv. They call this city Sataniv because it was a Jewish city, and the other neighbors call it Sataniv.
But that comes from Satan, as you say, right?
Yeah.
It's a village name for Satan.
And it's a big city today. Sataniv. And She told me in our city, the Germans, they did an example because it was a Jewish city. They didn't shoot the Jews. They brought all the Jewish community alive in a huge Turkish cave under the market. And they closed the gate with 2 meters of earth. She told me the market was moving during 7 days because the Jews tried to escape. It was in July 42. I remember I asked this woman, when did you reopen the gate? She told me in 54, because we had to renew the market. I remember this day, we stopped the interview for the moment. I need to breathe. But now, all my team, I would say, we try to stay strong enough not to move and to say, okay. By example, another woman, she told me, my brother was forced by the mayor to keep the Jews during the night, and if one Jew escaped, he had to shoot him. I was very quiet this day. I say, did your brother, he came back alive? Yes. And how many Jews tried to escape the first night? Two. So I understood immediately that he killed them. So I said, but it was a man or a woman? He told me two men. And I say, what he did with the corpse? Ah, I will show you. Here we discover the graves.
And how old would that child have been?
He was 14. So you see sometime also, you know, the Nazis, they used the Soviet system of requisition to have black workers. They changed the mayor, but they kept the Soviet system of requisition. And what was of our main discoveries in Yaradinunum, to see the imbrication between the Nazism and the Soviet requisition system.
Tell us a little bit about the Soviet requisition system. I'm not sure.
You know,
sure
in every municipality, you must understand that the Jews have never been killed in big cities. Even if they are from Nikolaev or from Lvov or from Tarnopil, they bring them in small village to isolate them, to kill them. Because the Nazis were not sure, they were not feeling safe. They were afraid of the Soviet partisan. So they isolate the Jews in the village. In every village, the mayor, in Soviet system, he has around him a council. Not elected people. When he wants something, by example, he wants to have 10 workers to bring back the grass of the field. It's a kolkhoz, Soviet way of cultivating. Okay. Every 10 person in the village, there is a guy called Desyatnik. The Desyatnik is the representative of the party for 10 person, one person, chosen by the mayor. When he says, I want 50 children for tomorrow to dig the grave or to do anything, he sends somebody from the council who goes to see the Desyatnik in their street and say, tomorrow, 50 person. The Desyatnik in the night, it knocks at the door, you. The morning at 8, they have not to know what for they are requisitioned. They know only the time. They receive a small paper. You must be in front of the municipality at 8.
This is well before the Germans ever came.
It was before the Germans arrived. It was a Soviet system, the regular Soviet system of requisition. Mm-hmm. It took me years to discover that. Nobody wanted to speak because the NKVD was checking the articulation between the mayors and these people. And I met last January, finally, the first Desyatnik. She was a woman. She did that during years. And I said, you did that voluntary or not? She told me, I will explain you. I was forced to make requisition of meat one day, of corn another day, of cows the third day. And one day I said to the NKVD, no, the NKVD, it was under the name of KGB, and say, there is nothing anymore for requisition in the village. The guy of NKVD told her, oh, good thing. Next meeting with the mayor, you will say it publicly, but there is nothing anymore for requisition. So it was a meeting, the normal meeting, and she said to the mayor in a small meeting in the municipality, you know, Mr. Mayor, we cannot make any more requisitions. The people have nothing anymore in the farm. She was sent 10 years in Siberia. So you must understand that these people who have been requisitioned by the system, they have never been found guilty by Soviet justice. Because everybody knows that when you are requisitioned, even if it's for a killing, you have no choice. It's that or Siberia.
I see.
Well, so the Nazi used this system, and until now, nobody understood why they arrived to sleep one night the day after they have workers. Because without the Soviet system, no Holocaust by bullets.
That's an amazing insight into the workings of this whole operation. They requisitioned adults too, though, not only children. They requisitioned adults and prisoners of war and hostages of all kinds. So it was a massive kind of operation. But what was clear was that as they launched this program in the Ukraine, which is different from what was happening in Poland and other places, they had the Germans had a very finely worked out set of protocols, a kind of whole administrative system as to what would happen when, who would go into the town, how the whole operation would work, the creation of a ghetto, as you write, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but you must understand, in West we imagine that Berlin phoned to Kiev, Kiev phoned to Lvov, Lvov phoned to... It was not working like that. It was completely decentralized Holocaust. Mm-hmm. At the leadership of each killing unit was a guy with a PhD in law. It was a condition. Himmler put this condition because he said it's necessary that this guy can decide what is good or no according to German law. So it was completely decentralized. Browning, in his book Origin of Final Solution, but the last book he wrote, said the problem for Himmler were not to order Holocaust, but to coordinate Holocaust. So you must understand also that it was an order to kill the Jews, but also an authorization to kill the Jews. It means it was legal to kill Jews and Gypsies. I will give you the worst example I met. I was in a family 2 months ago in Sataniv, because I came back 3 times. In some cities, we have to come back 3-4 times to know the truth. And say, oh, father, come visit my house. It was a Jewish house. So you see, it's near the synagogue, and they had a tunnel to hide and to run away if the German arrived, and so on. I say, okay. Can I open the camera? Oh, of course, father, no problem. How did you get the house? Oh, it was easy, because we found this house empty, the 2 babies were dead, the head crushed against the wall, and the teenager was in the entry with a bullet in the stomach, he was dead, and the mother never came back, so we took the house. Okay, what did you do with the corpse? I only stay at his ground, you know. I don't enter in. So I say, oh, I don't remember. We put them far away. I don't remember. Okay, stop the camera. It was not feeling good at all. I went outside of the house. The neighbor arrived running. Said, what did he tell you? Because people speak, it's public, you know. It's not an intimate interview. Said, he said that he put the corpse far away. He's lying. Come with me in his garden. We entered in his garden 2 meters from the gate, and she stood and she said, the corpse under my feet. He reopened the gate and said, like nothing, said, she says the truth. I reopened the camera like nothing. I said, oh, do you remember the names of the victims? Yeah, of course, they were all my schoolmates. And he began to write the list of the name of the wall with a paper. I have to come back again. I understood very clearly that this family killed the Jews themselves. Here you feel very bad. I found 5 houses like that in Sataniv. So don't forget, when you cut the law not to kill, you change completely a society. It was an authorization to kill, so you could kill the worst of the worst, a grandmother, an Ukrainian grandmother, her daughter married a Jew. She was Catholic and very upset of this wedding. The guy went to Red Army, like everybody. The Jews were Soviet citizens. One day, the daughter went to the market. She had six children. The grandmother, she brought the 6 children to the Gestapo, and they have been shot. And she came back, and she finished her life in her bed, like everybody, because it was legal. You must understand, there were the official killing by the Nazi. The non-official killing by the Nazi, because they didn't declare anything to Berlin, because they wanted to have official reports very well done, but they were far from Berlin. And the non-official killing of the neighbors. That was a genocide. It was so difficult for my team. Very frequently people ask me, why you have a bodyguard? A prisoner need a bodyguard. I say, you don't realize without bodyguard, it would have been finished in long time. One day in Kovel, somebody shot to us from a window. And it's very frequent with my team that there is an explosion of violence around.
It's frequent.
Very frequent. Very, very frequent. Without the bodyguard, it would be impossible.
That's not in the book.
I cannot write everything. You know, my book will be my book will be also published in Russian one day, and I want to keep my visa. So,
wow.
You must understand, if I wrote everything, it would be absolutely the end of my researches. Absolutely the end. So the researches will be accessible for students. We opened a study center in Paris, accessible for people who prepare a PhD with Paris 4, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And we have a convention with Paris 4, and because we have oral memory, archive, and all the artifacts, so anybody can study. But it's accessible to these people and to the families. But we have even to check with the deniers and with anti-Semite people. It's why it's not open window. It's less open than your library. You know?
Well, we're going to get to the deniers in a little while. We're going to get to your feelings as a priest about recent events in the Vatican and a recent decision by the Pope. And we're going to get as well to your identity as a Catholic priest doing this kind of work, because that's one of the more intriguing aspects of the kind of work that you do. But let's say a little bit with your findings. One of the things that you document in the book that you say is really a kind of unwritten chapter in the Holocaust is the use of young Jewish women as sex slaves.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was very difficult also to accept, to understand. As I told you, there were a lot of non-official killing. If you see the reports of the Einsatzgruppen, it's very clear. They arrive in a village, they shoot everybody, they make a report, because they want to be well considered by Berlin. So they want in an emergency the paper that the city is Judenfrei. Because Himmler established a competition between Einsatzgruppe, Ordnungspolizei, and SS. So everybody wanted to have the quicker reports. So if they find other Jews, they kill them, but they don't declare them. You saw in the small movie all the mass graves we opened. All these mass graves officially don't exist in German archives. All the Jews of Busk officially have been killed in another city. Why? Because they wanted a good report. I met in New York a survivor from Busk in a meeting. He told me, I am from Busk. I say, you are the first Jew alive I meet from Busk. And I asked him, how did you survive? He told me we were 1,600 sitting on the market. And one official German arrived from the region. He asked, how many Jews are still here? And so the official said, 1,600. He said, okay, I give you already you the paper. You don't fry. And this one now is in New York. But if they shoot people later, they don't declare them. All these shootings that you saw, it's women were hidden in the ghetto with their children. They buried alive 450 women and children found in the ghetto by gendarmerie, not by Einsatzgruppe. So, first thing.
The gendarmerie were the local Ukrainian police?
No, local German in this
local
case.
Local German.
And the guy went back in Germany and was appointed to a very high position in the police of Germany. And died last year. We found him only this year. But that. So, first thing, anybody with a pistol was asked to kill Jews. He could be Ukrainian or German or Polish or from anywhere. Secondly, the Nazis were far from Berlin. We always imagine that the Nazis finally say the truth between each other. And that they said the truth to Berlin. But by example, they don't kill people in secret. We always imagine it was in secret. They employ civilian. Officially, they don't employ civilian. And third, they keep Jewish women in the Gestapo. It was in Busk, same thing. One guy, he told me, there were 34 Jewish women working in Gestapo, and he gave me the list. I said, how do you know the list? He said, because he was working inside the Gestapo, the witness. So, okay. And he says, all the village saw them, because when you wanted to have a paper, you want to have an Ausweis, you go to the Gestapo, and you see the Jewish girls who are here cleaning the soil or something like that. I learned that at the end of the war, all these 34 Jewish girls were pregnant. The killing unit of Busk, as they knew them, they didn't dare to shoot them. So they called a killing unit from Sokal to come and to kill them. It took me 3 days to find the mass grave. Nobody wanted to speak. I learned that these Jewish girls, they knew that they would be shot. So they asked the Nazi to make a tour in truck just before the shooting to say goodbye to all the village. So all the village saw them saying goodbye. And finally, I found an old lady shaking like that in an isolated house near the forest. She told me, they shot the Jewish woman just here near to my house. But don't show yourself to my neighbor because he's a nationalist. He will beat me if I speak. You must understand that violence is strong. And that the people who are the family of the killers, I cannot even knock at the door. We have to pass around their house. Past is not past in Soviet Union. Soviet Union has frozen the time. For the people in their memory, it's like one day before. One woman, she was speaking because she saw a lady with children going to be shot. And suddenly she stopped speaking. She ran to her house. And I said, what happened? And my translator says, she told us, I stopped to speak. Because you don't know the German. If they come back, you don't know what they will do to me. For them, past is not past. Very frequently also, old people say, I spoke to you, but I'm sure they will send me to Siberia. And always the young children say, Mommy, Mommy, it's finished, Siberia. But for old people, nothing is finished. They saw so many things in the century.
It's hard. I think it's hard for me, at least, to imagine, you know, the extent of the psychological trauma that those children suffered by being requisitioned to do these unspeakable things. There is one of the ways that this book is brilliantly put together is that there's narrative by Father Desbois, then there are transcriptions of the interviews that he has had with a number of people in different communities, different villages, and then there are photographs, color photographs, of the people that he talked to and some of the landscapes. And so you get almost a three-dimensional kind of texture of history here. But there are parts of it that that I don't think I could read aloud. They're just too heartbreaking. And one of them is the requisitioning of this young schoolgirl that he talked about a few minutes ago, who is described as a presser, like you press clothes. But she was requisitioned with her other classmates, these little girls, to walk upon the naked bodies in this mass pit that had just been killed or not killed, wounded, some of whom were her best friends. And it's hard for me to imagine ever recovering from that kind of an experience and ever having any kind of a normal life afterwards.
They don't recover. They don't recover. You see the man who is crying inside the interview in the small seven movies. Why he cries? Because it's not also everything that we show here. In fact, after 1 month, they show he was dark-skinned. For the Nazi, to be dark-skinned was to be Jew. So they took him. He was naked in the line to be shot. And suddenly, his mother from the window saw he was in the line. So she ran from the farm, because the farm is here and the killing site is there. And she said, he's not Jew, he's not Jew. And a local policeman said, oh, sorry, he's not Jew. He took him outside and gave him. So for him, and he's living now perhaps 20 meters from the mass grave. So, you know, but you are here. It's why the book was not easy to write, how to transmit all these horrors, to make conscious that a genocide, it's a crime. Every person was killed by one person personally. No machine, no train, no gas chamber in East. It was a personal crime, and these Nazis were not superhero, were only criminal, like serial killers. Every day killing people differently according to their phantasm. One day we arrive in a village, they say, oh no, the chief of the unit, he was drunk, so he refused the other German to shoot. He asked for a table with sausage and vodka, and he put all the gun on the table, and he asked the Jew to pass in front of the table, and he was shooting like that. And so at the end of the day, he made a public discourse that he shot 1,530 Jews, I think I remember. And more than that, he asked for water. He washed his hands in front of everybody to show it was not his crime. And he threw the water behind. Every crime is different. It's a crime, in fact. A genocide, in this case, is a personal crime every time. It's why Yair Adinunum. And, you know, we show that now there is an exhibition in New York who is in Jewish Heritage Museum. We try to show to the people, the witnesses, the artifact. But even to build an exhibition was not simple. It took us 1 year in Paris to know what we will show to the people. If we show nothing, they will think, okay, they have been shot. If we show too many things, unconsciously, people will block. So we had to find, if you visit this exhibition, you will be drawn. We make people follow the criminal from the beginning of the day that we arrive in the village until the last moment. But it's not easy. You don't see bones. We don't see awful things. But you follow the people until the last moment. Imagine that the witnesses, they remember the last words of the dead people. Hannah, she was hidden in a barrack with five other children, and you see that in your exhibition, David. She was hidden in a barrack looking at the execution, and suddenly she saw Itzrik, her boyfriend, with all the family naked, arriving to be shot. And Itzrik saw that Hannah was watching. So Anna turned and said, bye-bye, life. 6 years after, she remembers. And for us, it's surely the most difficult thing to accept when they remember one person with a name, a family name, and the last words. One family in Simferopol, 4 years old, a girl, a Krimshak girl, Sephardic girl, Judeo-Tatar. Finally, they arrested her. They tried to hide this small child during all the work. It didn't work. At the end, they took her in a truck. They sent two neighbors in emergency with cars and horses to try to ask not to shoot this small girl. They shot in this place 11,000 persons. It's near Simferopol, capital of Crimea. And the neighbor they saw that she was naked in the snow, only the shoes. It was minus 17. And she didn't understand anything. And she asked to the Nazi, please give me back my coat. I give you my shoes. And they shot to the child. You know, it's every time a crime, a personal crime. It's like, because very frequently people tell me, how did it work? I say, it didn't work. It was a crime. With one criminal, with witnesses, with assistant, and with one victim. Because one bullet, one Jew. Every person has been killed by one person. And we estimate that one German per three who cross the border killed Jews and Gypsies.
We have no idea how many Gypsies were killed, do we?
Impossible. We found many, many mass graves of Gypsies, but never one mass grave has even a small souvenir, a small zikaron, nothing. Killed like animals, buried like animals. We know only same story of the shooting, exactly the same story. They never shot, according to what we find, the Gypsies in the same place as the Jews, and not the same day. They shoot also the disabled people. We found in front of an orphanage, they built a huge mass grave. They asked all the children of the orphanage to go outside, and they shot them and closed them. And the worst is that today the village made a big memorial with all the name of the children, but they took outside one child was Jew, and they put the corpse away without any name. Nobody wanted to say where is the corpse.
Really?
Because he was Jew.
And that happened how recently?
Yeah.
That happened...
You must understand, it's not like here we are quiet, it's a very nice place, etc. Story is not finished.
You do, at the same time, tell a number of stories of Ukrainians who saved Jewish people. And you have a note that indicates that 400 of them were recognized, I think, by the State of Israel afterwards. So there are a few heroic stories and stories of...
Yeah, there were 2,300 Ukrainians who received the Medal of Writers Among the Nations. We met with my team a few ones. One day I was at the commemoration of Holocaust by the rabbi in Babi Yar, and I met an old lady. She was dancer in opera. She told me, "I have been saved by my nanny." My nanny was in fact a Christian, and she came with all the family to be shot. We didn't know we were to be shot. We were thinking to be deported. And suddenly the mother said, "Take back the children. Say it's yours." So the nanny took the children and went to see the killer and say, "They are not Jew, it's mine." So she was hurted by a killer but not killed. And so she was asked to hide herself with the children behind the luggage. And she watched the killing of 34,000 people in 2 days. And after she could go back home. And now one of the child, who is now a grandmother, she survived and she was dancer in the ballet of Kiev. And she arrived to the commemoration with the little daughter of her.
Wow. Let's talk about you. You really learned about the Holocaust. The first photographs that you ever saw of the Holocaust were in a library.
Yeah.
When you were young.
So I have a strong debt to the library.
Well, I think we all do. Libraries have great enduring value as sources of documentation and as, in effect, not only the preservers of documents, but also as a consequence of that function that we have, we, in effect, in a passive kind of way, help become the conscience of humanity. But that you tell a sort of circular story in the book that you inadvertently almost retrace the footsteps of your paternal grandfather, who was a French prisoner of war. And as you, I don't want to give the conclusion away, but so I won't. But he is there at the beginning with you as a boy, and then he comes back at the end. A man who really never talked very much about his experience in the war, and you don't know how he got back from the camp back to the family home. But your education was all in public schools. My education was all in Catholic schools. I have a Jewish wife and a Jewish child. You're a Catholic priest who came out of a very secular educational tradition and a secular orientation in France, and nonetheless had a vocation to become a Roman Catholic priest. First serving as a parish priest, ultimately in Lyon, one of the major cities of France. And then through a variety of circumstances, you became deeply knowledgeable through the kinds of study that you did in Israel as well as elsewhere in the Jewish faith and Jewish tradition and Jewish history. You studied Hebrew, and you became, through the course of a meeting with your cardinal, you became one of the key representatives of the Catholic Church to the Jewish community in France, but then also an advisor to the Vatican in terms of Catholic-Jewish relations. And in addition to those terribly important roles, which in and of themselves would make a hugely important career, you have been, with your team, but really through your work, I was about to say single-handedly, it's not single-handedly, but were it not for you, the kind of history that you've written, the documentation that you've created of the Holocaust in Ukraine simply wouldn't have been written. So that's a very, very big package in you. But let's talk about the church today relative to the Jewish people and to Jewish history, as well as to the Holocaust. And more specifically, let's talk about the most recent incident that has upset people worldwide, I guess, about the rescission of an act of excommunication on a renegade English Williams. Cleric who is a Holocaust denier. And what does that act on the part of the Pope do to you? You who have seen the evidence, you who've been there with your hands in the ground, you who've seen the bones, who've seen the bullets, who've talked to the witnesses, who has an encyclopedic knowledge of what happened in one country and a deep, deep knowledge of what happened in other countries, do you feel betrayed by the Pope in this particular action? And as a man, as a scholar, as a human being, as an advocate for the recognition of what happened to the Jews, in effect, for being a Catholic champion of the Jewish people in their story during the war, how does this sit with you, and how do you deal with that? If that's not too unfair a question to ask in public, but.
First, I could answer only in a diplomatic way because I'm a diplomat for Vatican, and I will not. You know, it was first a shock. I came back just from Ukraine, from a very, very difficult travel near the south of Tarnopil and Lvov, and we just found a small camp of where they shot 6,000 Jews. And I even found back the guy was serving the food every Monday on order to the mayor, to the camp. I remember they said how the guards were playing with young children, Jewish children. They threw them from the mirador, and the other were shooting in her, and so on. We found all the mass graves. I took the plane with my team of Yaradu Nunum, and I heard the radio, a certain Williamson was saying that Holocaust never existed, according to him. But the maximum 200,000 people were killed and no gas chamber. It was a shock. A shock, a double shock. First, because it's a new denier. I know already strongly about Faurisson and all these people. Of course, they are my enemy. But to see a bishop, somebody who says he's a bishop, to say that, it's a strong step. I was immediately reacting to say, it could be the beginning of the banalization of denial, because now witnesses unfortunately disappear one after another. And I always said, when the witnesses will go on disappearing, the deniers will go on appearing like rats in a boat, you know. You must know that we decided this year between Yarad, Bernardin, the Catholic New Catholic University of Paris, and Sorbonne Paris-Cat to build a seminar, a symposium next June about secret operation 1005 that nobody studied. What was this operation? In June 42, it's a very warm summer. All the mass graves all explode. So all the neighbors of the mass grave write to Berlin, we cannot bear anymore this story. So Himmler and Heydrich decided to appoint Nazi Paul Blobel for a secret intervention called 1005 to unbury all the corpses and to burn them 2,000 by 2,000 in every village in front of everybody. Fortunately, the Red Army arrived quicker than they were thinking, so they had to stop. Why they did that? Because they didn't only burn the corpses. They bought machines, special machines, bone crushers, to destroy the last bones in every village because they didn't want to count. They were afraid to be judged by the dead corpse. It was the building of the denier of this Holocaust. For me, it's very clear that Williamson, Ahmadinejad, Faurisson, and so on, for different reasons perhaps, they are only the sons of Himmler and Heydrich. And I said that very clearly in the media in France. And I was very happy also that the two main cardinals of France, Paris and Lyon, condemned completely and said that there was no compatibility between to be a denier of Holocaust, of course, and to be a bishop, and even to be an honest person. So we are in this position. It's not easy. I was happy that even his group, the Fraternity Pi 10th, told him to stop. You know, this guy, he was sent outside of Argentina, now he's in England, and we know through the media that he contacts Irving with only one question: how can I speak without putting in trial? So you must understand that Himmler and Heydrich, they knew that Holocaust existed. They did it. They did it. So the deniers, it's not an intellectual position. It's an anti-Semite position. That's something else. It's a conclusion of hate in your brain. You know also that in France, like in Germany, it's forbidden to be a denier by law. So when somebody is a denier, he can go to jail. That's a big difference. It's why we are sure he will never land in France and in Germany now. Mm-hmm. But I am very afraid, never mind, I still go on thinking that it's the beginning of the tsunami of the deniers. Because it's a way to cut the bottom of the legitimacy of the Jewish people. You know, I never met a denier who loves the Jews.
This is my last question, and then we'll take some from the audience for about 15 minutes or so. But staying with the same subject, you are an official advisor to the Vatican. So here we have a denier, but then here we have a pope who made a decision to repeal his excommunication. Whether or not he knew about Williamson's position as a denier almost becomes irrelevant. So how do you relate to your how do you relate to the Vatican on this? How do you communicate your feelings, which obviously are enormously passionate and eloquent, persuasive, because you've got more evidence in one pore of your body about what really happened than anybody imaginable. So what do you tell them? In your official position, what do you do?
Now you enter in actuality and no more in history.
Uh-huh.
And so, concretely, I received a letter last week from the Embassy of France to Holy See in Roma. If I accepted that an event could be built in the French embassy with different cardinals and to speak about Holocaust. I have diplomas. I went to university. Everywhere, it could be in a farm in Ukraine, it could be here, it could be in a house of a millionaire, I try to stay a very simple person who says directly the facts that nobody can turn around. So I will do the same. I will not speak about denial and that. I will tell them what happened in this village to this boy, because I don't do that in global with the Jewish people. I find back the mass grave where David, Gloria, Itzrik, the family, Hefner, the daughter, and that have been shot one by one. So my duty is to come back to Vatican through this diplomatic way and to say, here we are. But, only there is an African proverb to say we cannot make drink a donkey who doesn't want to drink. So it will depend on the people who will come concretely. I think... also, it depends if the people in their cursus had an historical background or if everything is inside theology. Where everything is inside theology, there is no place for history.
Well, I think those of us on your side who are the vast majority have to hope that you will break down the doors of that way of thinking and insert history into theology, because otherwise... I think we will have more murders and more tolerance of murder and injustice in the future. Father Desbois, thank you very, very much. This has been an extraordinary experience.
If I could trouble you to, if you have a question, and I insist rather on a question than a comment, I would very much encourage you to come up to the mic right in the middle. I know it's a little bit difficult to get there, but we are recording this event, and we will be also able to hear your question, which does matter.
Hi, my name is Michael. I'm currently reading Amazon's new book, Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides by Professor Dalton. And my understanding from reading that book is that Holocaust revisionism started in France from the left. Paul Rosanier, who was a concentration camp survivor, when he started questioning it in 1946. So I think it's unfair of you to suggest that Dr. Forreston, who you claim is your enemy, is the creator of French Holocaust revisionism, which is not the case. And Israel is the first country in the entire planet in 1986 to pass Holocaust denial laws, because there are Jews in Israel who...
What is your question?
There are Jews in Israel who do not agree with the Holocaust narrative, and there are also scholars in Israel that don't agree with the Holocaust narrative. That's closer to Bishop Williamson's suggestion that maybe gas chambers were not used as a murder weapon.
What is your question?
My question is that, what about Paul Rosenier, who's the father of Holocaust revisionism? He's also a concentration camp survivor.
So, you must understand, if you want to know about what I'm doing, I'm ready to invite you on the ground to meet with the witnesses. So if you want to meet with me after, I'm ready. And I can guarantee you to welcome in Ukraine, discuss with the people, look at the bones, the ballots, and to investigate. If you are ready to spend time on that, we are ready to meet each other. For the rest, I'm not competent. And you must also understand that I work with people who work on other genocide. I work with Armenian. And I helped them find the mass grave in Syria, at the border of Iraq, last summer. I work with people who work on the genocide in Rwanda. I don't know if you have been in Rwanda a long time ago. Full of mass graves, too. I work with people who work on the mass violence in Bosnia, who are looking for the bones. We are connected to each other. But I always saw that the people who deny an Holocaust don't take care of another genocide. It's very strange, but most of the deniers, for example, I'm from France. There are very few people that I know who deny the existence of Napoleon, even if they hate Napoleon. But I never met a denier of Napoleon. Even in Belarus, who is not the most open country, nobody denies Napoleon. But I meet a lot of deniers of the Holocaust of the Jews. So I always wonder why.
Okay, we'll go on. Yes, ma'am.
Well, first, thank you for what you've done. It's stunning. I had two questions. In the video, in the section with the mass graves, it said that only the top layer of the mass graves were touched and the other layers were left alone for religious reasons. Could you just clarify that?
Yeah.
And then my other question was, you mentioned children who were requisitioned dealing with Jewish children that they'd gone to school with, but then you also mentioned the situation in the ghetto. And I was just wondering, were there both situations where the Jews were separate and isolated and other situations where they were integrated into the community?
Yeah. So for the first question, you know, I am engaged in Jewish-Catholic dialogue, and of course we are very careful to respect the Jewish laws, and of course the Jewish laws according to the statute of the corpse, the dead corpse. In the Jewish tradition, we must not move a corpse when it's buried. And so we have been accepted. We never opened the grave. We opened the grave only for Busk, but we made a 27 days excavation with an official archaeologue of Ukraine, who, of course, never knew about the genocide of the Jews. And under the shomer, under the eye of an Orthodox rabbi that I asked from Israel, was the president of Zaka, an Israeli organization. So in this case, as officially it was not a Jewish place of killing, we could open. But at the moment we could establish really it was the Jewish victims, we had to stop. But nevertheless, in any case, we couldn't move one bone. It's a Jewish law. Not only for victims. It was an accident, it would be the same. So the first thing. The second question, you are right. In certain villages, there were Jewish school and Polish school. Or Jewish school and Ukrainian school. But in most of the villages, they were in the same school. Don't forget that it was Soviet Union in the East. So people couldn't organize themselves in religious communities. And you are right that in Busk, it was only one school, so they were in the same school. When they did the ghetto, the Germans do the ghetto when they arrive, but the ghetto is not an Ukrainian structure. It's a Nazi structure. So they separate the population for a while, but it's not ghetto like in Poland. In some villages, the ghetto is for 1 week. Just
It's a structure to prepare the killing. It's not a ghetto like in Warsaw or in Krakow. It's not the same story. In Eastern Ukraine, I mean.
Yes. Next question.
About 2 years ago, a book was released in France called Les Bienveillants by Jonathan Littell, and it was a book written as fiction about Ukraine and covered many of the things that you talk about, even though it was fiction. It was released today in America as The Kindly Ones, and the person who reviewed it for the New York Times didn't like it at all. Now, Jonathan Littell in France was given the Goncourt one, the grand prize.
Bienveillant.
It was very, very well received in France.
Yeah.
Would you like to comment on that? Not necessarily the book itself, but the difference between the way a book like that would be received in France and in America?
But I cannot comment about the difference of reception. I can comment about the book itself. I read it. First, even if I didn't like it, I had no choice professionally. I had to read it. First, it's a very, very, very well-documented book. I think the man who wrote this book, he read any article who has been published, mostly in Germany, between 50 and 80. Because I found back all the articles. And when he tells you that Paul Blobel suddenly becomes mad in one night and wants to shoot everybody and is brought to an hospital, it's true. When he says that in this village they buried the people in the water and so on, it's true. All that is extremely documented. And for France, in public opinion, it was received as the first wave of sensibilization to what happened in East. Only what I don't like in this book for me personally is the way sometimes the killing are described in a very obscene way. And the other thing I don't like is that I don't understand why the writer had to put himself in the brain of an imaginary Nazi. Because I'm afraid that some people who are very friendly with Nazi feel safe to travel like in a fiction, but a very long fiction. But never mind, I would say I recommend the book to many people because they learn so many details about what happened and everything that is said is true according to historian.
Thank you. We'll have one more question, and then we'll move to a book signing. Yes.
Merci beaucoup. We had the opportunity to see the exhibit down at the Museum of Jewish Heritage, and I'd recommend that everybody in the room is interested to go to see it. My question, in terms of the Holocaust and Vatican-Jewish relationship, would you please comment on the beatification of Pope Pius?
Pi 12. First, I can comment, it's only a comment. The archives are not completely opened. The archives in Vatican are open until 39. So we know everything about Pi 12 before he is Pi 12. At the time he was nuncio in Germany. First, when they opened this amount of archives, there were not so many scholars who ran to Vatican to study, because it's an amount. I know a lot of friends who are working in connection with Vatican archivists to push to open the rest of the archives from 39 to 45 before speaking of any beatification. And I don't know where will be the end. You know, when a beatification happens, it's after a long, long processes, but when it begins to be public, it's very quick. But I know that today, and after Williamson affair, it's a very, very sensitive subject. Me, in my point of view, as historian, I think that without reading all the archives, it's difficult to speak. Because we always overvalorize, in my point of view, the relations between Pi 12 and the Western countries, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and so on, Holland. But I read very, very few about the links between Pi 12 and Poland and Ukraine, where are the biggest, unfortunately, the biggest number of victims. and Poland was a complete Catholic country. And Western Ukraine, the Greco-Catholic archbishop named Stepinski sent 5 reports to the Pope at the end of 41, beginning of 42, when he began to see the killings. The first four reports were censored by the Nazi, but the last one arrived to Vatican. I don't know anything about an answer. It's inside the archives. And the correspondence between the Vatican and the nunciature in Warsaw would be very interesting to know. So I know now many historians who are friends with the church, Jewish historians, who are willing to open only these few files to really know what happened on the burning place. Because Poland is a key question for that.
Now, let me just say a few things in conclusion. Father Desbois' work is not over, because now that so much work has taken place on the Ukraine, he's broadening his investigations into Belarusia and...
Russia. And normally, we are very near to do it in Poland, because 1 Jew per 10 in Poland, unfortunately, has been shot, because they were shooting before bringing the people in the ghetto. And there were many shootings inside the ghetto.
I have a sense that your work will never end, to be honest. And it is so terribly important. If you're interested in supporting his work, go to the website, www.holocaustbybullets.org.
.com.
I do ask you as well, as Paul did, to support the New York Public Library. These are not easy times for us, and next year is going to be really, really bad, as you can imagine. So if you value what we do, if you value what Paul Holden-Graeber and his wonderful team does in bringing you these programs, become a friend. It costs next to nothing, and it's really important. I'd like to thank Paul for helping arrange this wonderful evening. I'd like to thank you all for coming. This has been one of the great evenings in my life, and I've met one of the great people, one of the greatest people I think I'll ever meet. So it's an honor to be with you, and I'm sure that we all feel the same way. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank you, Paul. Thank you very much.